Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real people discuss events, technology and work life in the networking industry. This week, we're focusing on talking about HP networking products. And sometimes, although we normally gather articles and various ideas, this week we want to get comfortable around the workbench and talk about HP networking and some of their technology products, since many of you asked us to go deep. Of course, we'd love to hear your feedback about today's show, so feel free to send emails to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking and where we're going wrong, and tell us where we can new ideas for shows and things like that. Don't forget to check out the podcast website at http://packetpushers.net. Leave comments on today's show or follow us on Twitter at packetpushers. And of course, let's introduce the people on the show today. Ethan, what's been happening with you this week?
Hey, it's getting cold up here in New Hampshire, Greg, for sure. Winter is coming. And that's good for me. I'm excited about that. Now today it's kind of, you know, this will be like a diving deep on HP kind of stuff, but also a little bit of a salesy for me because I've been spending my day fighting a Cisco 6500 that doesn't want to behave. I get the whole thing configured, upgraded the iOS, reloaded it, and it decided, yeah, I don't know anything about myself, who I am, any of the code that you put in, it's all gone. I reloaded it again after making very sure I did my right mem, and it's still not going well. So, well, this is your chance, man. You can sell me an issue.
Well, maybe our guest can make a big pitch to you on today's show. I'd like to welcome Lynn Neese. Lynn Neese is a director from HP. How you doing? Tell us a bit about yourself.
Sure, I'm doing very well. I'm a director of advanced technology, so to speak, in our HP networking group. And this is really an amalgamation of people from the former 3Com and former HP networking, used to be called ProCurve. And my role is to sort of drive strategy, technology strategy going forward for the business.
Fantastic. Let me ask on a small point. Is there a not so advanced technology division? Sorry.
No, we are all advanced technologies in HP networking.
Sorry. I just figure if there's an advanced, there must be a not quite so advanced or, you know, just, you know, whatever, director of technology.
That's right. So the way we're organized is we have a couple of large three product business units, the Tipping Point Security Group. We have the A-Series business, which is really sort of like a former high-end core switching routing from 3Com. And then, of course, we have the E-Series business, or Essentials, which is primarily some of the former ProCurve products that you may be familiar with.
Yeah, I'm sure most of the listeners have had something to do with ProCurve in the last period of time, because that ProCurve product's been reasonably successful. And a lot of people tell us that people have been leaving comments on my blog saying, you know, the ProCurve product's been working for me and stuff like that.
Very good.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's jolly nice of them to tell us anyway.
My spiders are doing their work. Anyway, go ahead.
So perhaps let's cover a little bit about the HP and 3Com integration, because, you know, before the merge, there was HP ProCurve, and then obviously 3Com and joined HP, and there's been a wonderful love-in going on ever since. And the products, that one of the items that's concerned me about the integration is that there's so many products in the feature set there. And the story that's coming back from HP is let the customers decide. So you're sort of saying, well, we're going to put all the products out there as a family, and whichever ones the customers buy are the ones we're going to go forward. Is that still the story? Is that still the plan going forward?
So I can give you a little bit of background on where that sort of let the customer decide. We do have some overlap in the product line. We know that, and we're not going to get rid of it anytime soon. In fact, so we have some very large customers in Europe and in North America who are traditional ProCurve customers. They rely on the discount special deal they got with HP. They've deployed thousands of units. Nothing in that product line is going away. By the same token, if you go to China, you know, someplace like China Mobile, where they're using a lot of our core switching, routing, and also edge products, they're all Comware based. We're not going to alienate either customer base. And in fact, we intend to continue to support indefinitely what you would think of as the strain of products associated with both strains. Eventually there will be some consolidation, but it won't mean things going away. What it'll more likely mean, and this is one of the projects, in fact, that I'm working on, is that you'll see a superset of capabilities. You know, everybody's proprietary MIBS, the management software from both sides with capabilities. If you were a ProCurve customer, you're not going to think anything's gone away. If you're a Calmware customer, you're not going to think anything's gone away.
Okay.
I don't know if that makes sense.
As someone who is a strategist for corporate organizations and somebody who sits down and evaluates companies on a 5 and a 10 year horizon, if I look at a product line and there's too many products in a product set, I get concerned because I might pick a family of those products and then realize that they've gone dead very soon after I've made that decision. So, for example, recently with Cisco, we made a decision to standardize on 7300 routers, and now they're dead 2 years after we've made the decision. Admittedly, because of silicon manufacturing problems, but notwithstanding, it's a mistake to make those decisions and then get stuck.
Well, so I've got good news for you. Cisco's probably going to stop doing that. And I'll tell you why. It's because of us.
Yeah.
The truth of the matter is we don't. HP in the ProCurve side never obsoleted products. We don't discontinue. If we do discontinue a product because there's no one still buying it in an active new manner, and with the lifetime warranty that we had for years, the ProCurve will replace old products. And a lot of customers have built an entire operation around that. The obsolescence that Cisco does is a direct result of their kind of historical monopoly power. The truth is they can, and it's operational to their advantage to do it, and no one makes them pay for it. But we think we're actually now a viable competitor to Cisco. So the good news is I suspect they will stop doing the, I don't know what you call it, draconian obsolescence of products that they've grown accustomed to in the past years. That's good news for the customer.
Yeah, I can see there's two sides to that debate. One side to that debate for me is, on one hand, Cisco is making products obsolete and causing, creating opportunities in the market to grow to the next level, of which I'm grateful.
Right.
On the other hand, sometimes we see products that are end of life before the end of their life. They're fresh, they're new, still delivering good value, but they're end of life far too early.
Exactly. And those are the products. I think when Cisco does that, the behavior is just a result of their monopoly power. It's that simple. They won't end of life products with the same aggression, I think, 2 years from now, 3 years from now. We're very big, and now that we have a full portfolio from the 3Com products, we can compete for RFPs, virtually any network infrastructure RFP now. And so as they run into that competition, they will find that they're creating compelling events with those end of lives and creating opportunities for us, so they'll stop doing it.
So HP and 3Com have merged, and the portfolio looks to me like it's pretty much a high end, a medium, and then a low. And the technologies that interest myself and Ethan is the data center products, and that's the A-series switches. And so tell me a little bit about how the A-series matches up to people's data center needs, and talk perhaps a little bit into this new, is it the Fabric? Your recent Fabric announcement, I'm trying to remember that name of it.
You're talking about the FlexFabric announcement?
That's the one. I knew it had something in it like that.
Yeah, that's from our technology called Virtual Connect. I'll come to that in just a minute. So if we think about where data center networks have evolved very recently, there's been a push towards very large flat segments. And the fact that there are no longer ports on switches that people would call edge ports or station ports. Every port is a trunk in a virtualized environment. And so as a result, we've got all these multiplexing trunking technologies coming out of either servers or blade chassis. We call ours Virtual Connect. You're familiar with virtual switching. There have been a lot of forays into how to abstract these multiplexers, and I'll come to that in a minute. But the real key requirement on the core switching side of things is to get very large, flat, low latency domains. And the rationale is both how do I move servers around using vMotion and the like without changing their IP address, i.e., a large layer 2 segment. And then secondly, how do I free myself up from having to provision servers with some a priori knowledge of the physical layout of the data center? In other words, if I have a couple servers that I want to be Oracle rack nodes with a private heartbeat and state copy between them, or the lock management between them, I don't want to have to know that what rack one is in, so I can put the other one in the same rack. So latency across the network, levels of oversubscription are dropping for such a network, but the cost structure is what stands to suffer. And obviously, you're going to hear some people talk a lot about, you know, fiber channel over Ethernet is a critical requirement. I think that that the storage side of this, and I'll come back to it in a minute, is going to be a different topic forever, and I'll explain why. But against a flat, large network, where the A-Series impressed us a lot. And by the way, we're using it in all of our new data centers now. We replaced our Cisco infrastructure to core and backbone in 3 months. And that's because we'd gone to industry standard protocols across the network ahead of time. So the benefit of A-Series is that with our basically 3,000 engineers we have across the globe, and many of them in low-cost regions, brilliant people in China, for example, who came out of the H3C acquisition, we can keep up with the latest and greatest merchant ASICs at the high end. If you look at our A12500, you've got Marvell chipset in that, and the A9500, you've got Broadcom chipsets, and the 7500s and down. By being able to use the latest and greatest chips, we're able to have products that tend to have hardware capabilities that are cutting edge. Example here is you take a Force 10 box, you take a Foundry box, you take a CAT 6500, and things like virtual output queuing are done in a separate chip from where you get classification and forwarding decisions made. The point there is with all those crossings of chip inside of a traditional high-end core switch, the latencies are typically in the 25 to 30 microsecond range. With our A12500, things like virtual output queues are embedded in the same ASIC as the classification and forwarding logic. What that means is I only have like two or three chip crossings in a fat tree to get through that switch. It's 8 microseconds.
So you're coming off the back plane straight into one chip and then presenting directly to the front of the blade.
Exactly. What looks like a software advantage turns into a hardware advantage because of our productivity.
Okay, so you're saying come straight off the physical, you'll have your fire where your SerDes is for the gig 10 gig ports, straight into one chip, and then one chip onto the back plane. The back plane will be where your CLOS-based infrastructure is. You'll have the fabric switching, what Cisco calls fabric switching, which is their silicon CLOS-based fabric infrastructure for the back plane, and then struggled to get hold of documentation on how the A-Series works at the technical layer. So I'd like to drill into that with a few more questions because I haven't been able to get the architectural view. Modules have one chip for all 10, or do they have multiple chips? And the connectivity to the backplane on the A-Series, is it a single channel? Is it multi-channel?
Well, so it's a CLOS fabric and it's multi-path. And the routing decisions through the CLOS fabric are dynamic. So it's not just a static hash, but I think you can actually route around congestion through the backplane. In fact, it might make sense to at some point have more of a follow-up on the CLOS fabric and the 12500.
Yep.
But this is a merchant chipset.
Yep.
You're probably familiar with the, you know, I think it was. I don't want to go into the names of the vendors. I guess I'm not supposed to now that I think about it.
Yeah.
but you know them well. You know them well. There's one chip crossing into the CLOS and another chip crossing for the QoS and out egress queuing. And it's a very efficient architecture. The number of routes we can support at wire speed, like 1.5 million, I believe, with the firmware upgrade coming to the 12500. 500K of those can be IPv6 routes. That kind of stuff matters a lot in China because China probably has fewer IPv4 addresses in your house.
They've got different scaling requirements in China. The numbers are sort of scary in terms of, as I understand, in terms of feet on the ground. And like you say, a lot of it's IPv6 there already because they don't have enough IPv4.
Exactly. So the 12500 and 9500 tend to share that architecture.
Yep.
And all of them support this IRF function, which I see we might be talking about here in a few minutes.
Yeah, well, IRF's a key part of your value prop going forward. I want to come back to your multipath. You have a module connected into the 12500 and you have a silicon forwarding engine on the module that's connecting to the backplane. So there's a single connection into the backplane. Is it an 80 gig? Is it how big's that pipe onto the backplane?
We can get 128. The answer is I have to do the math in my head right now.
Okay.
I haven't looked at the backplane here in a few weeks, but our capability is 128 10 gig ports at line rate on an 18 slot chassis. So I think it's upwards 100 gig per line card.
Right, and that's delivering today.
Yes, that's today.
Right,
and that will grow double and quadruple within the next 18 months.
Right. New silicon, new modules, new supervisors, or is that going to require a...
So there's some of it does not require new, there, you know, the fabric and the nodes are on different, slightly different life cycles at times.
Yeah.
And I believe we have a fabric upgrade capability and a node upgrade capability without requiring any new generations of chips. So I can't quote you on the roadmap offhand, but I can get that information for people who want it.
All right. Well, people could talk to you about it and get a view on how that looks and understand things.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So now you also seem to be subscribing to the large flat network theory, or what I otherwise refer to as the flat earth.
Yes. And that's where IRF comes. Exactly. That's where both the low latency, high port densities, low oversubscription, and things like IRF come in.
Yeah. Well, let me just back off a little bit into a quasi-religious issue, is that all the vendors, I mean, VMware, HP, you know, many of the switching vendors are saying large flat networks are going to be the way forward. And yet for the last 20 years, we've had bridging bad, routing good, for very good reasons, right? Now, let me also point out that, you know, that Cisco, who owns this market space, has had a market strength around routing and perhaps have overdone the routing issue just a little bit. I'd happily agree with that. But on the other hand, I also have had any number of horrendous experiences around, you know, flat layer 2 networks going back 20 years. How can we suddenly turn around and say, don't worry about it, layer 2 networks with 5,000 machines in it isn't going to be a problem?
Well, if you put on a blindfold, you can do it. I'm kidding. One of the technologies that, so I was in HP before the acquisition of 3Com, and one of the aspects of the technologies brought by 3Com, actually it's H3C, taking 3Com IP and making good on it with products, was this intelligent resilient framework, the IRF, switch virtualization. It's very, very mature.
Yeah.
So the hope we have is that the experience and maturity of that technology makes large bridged flat networks more practical, more feasible, and less of a nightmare to deal with.
So you're claiming that that the recent developments in multi-chassis aggregated, like multi-chassis, yes, multi-channels, I think most of us are coming to call MLAG, multi-channel link aggregated groups of chassis.
Exactly.
Bonding two chassis into one or whatever is abolishing this loop problem that we've had.
That's right. So the only reason that you would run spanning tree is either you're a traditionalist or you have some sort of configuration that you need that cannot be supported by something like a switch virtualization technology. But we think that what we got with 3Com's IRF is about as good as it gets. And what's very nice about IRF, it's a horizontal stacking solution. So you take each tier of a topology. If you have a three-tier aggregation, then you might have a core, or you have an aggregation distribution core. Layer 2, layer 3, doesn't matter. It's a full switch virtualization. 50 milliseconds recovery time. So if I have to reconverge a network after a failure, 50 milliseconds is by far the best in the industry. That's really a result of just 10 years of engineering that's gone into IRF, everything from how master election occurs to how I deal with split-brained, how I deal with state copy, et cetera. And when you multi-chassis lag into an IRF cluster of switches, you can basically arrange it so that traffic never crosses through the so-called stacking links. But you can hash in such a way and optimize in such a way where all north-south traffic takes the path you would want it to take unless there's a failure that forces traffic to a stacking link.
Yeah.
Point being is the technology is very mature, and in the absence of having to deal with multi-instance spanning tree, the complexity of management can drop for the number of ports. The other thing is, by the way, high-density switches obviously help with this problem too, right? So I can take two 12500s and give you over 1,000 10-gig ports with only 4-to-1 oversubscription. Yeah, that's not too bad. That's a rather large domain right there with what is essentially one switch, no VRRP, no spanning tree.
I'm still struggling to understand, because it's not only – see, to me, very large layer 2 domains, I understand that MLAG technologies – you know, as you say, IRF is going to give us bonded chassis and we've got great algorithms. But, you know, I remember simple things from years gone by, like faulty NICs taking out an entire layer 2 space. And I remain dubious yep. about the value of the, you know, I've seen any number of layer two events happen. Somebody was saying the other day they had a problem where a Windows server suddenly started spewing broadcasts because it had a net BUI failure. Sorry, a net BIOS failure. Not a net BUI, a net BIOS failure. And just took down an entire layer two segment. I mean, we haven't solved it. These problems haven't been solved. You know, this concept of a vast layer two domain and VMware suddenly, you know, a magic spell occurs and the laws of time and space haven't changed, you know.
That's right. No, that's true. That's true. Right. You know, the other thing you're going to see an evolution of, and this goes beyond just HP's, you know, A-series products today or E-series products today, but we've made advanced strides in here of OpenFlow, and we're seeing a lot of startups that are attacking the problem you're talking about, which is where you actually get some degree of network isolation.
Okay, hang on there. What we need to do is we probably need to tell people about OpenFlow because I don't think everybody knows a little bit too much about it. Do you want to brief us about what that is?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can think of OpenFlow as an API for programming the switching plane of a switch, basically telling it how to populate its forwarding tables, how to wake you up when it learns a new MAC address, how to forward packets to the appropriate place when I have a routing process running in the switch, et cetera. And so OpenFlow is like opening up the switching plane of a network ASIC. And it's a industry. We'll call it an emerging industry standard. It's not like a traditional IEEE or IETF standard, but everybody now is looking at OpenFlow as a method for providing software-based switching control, and the control can be centralized. And one of the phenomena that's led to the early success of OpenFlow is people recognize that multi-core x86 chips today can handle an incredible number of events in a network environment. The number of MAC learns required per second in a data center environment is actually not all that high. The events that would cause a reconvergence are not all that numerous today that were not feasible from an IO device on a, you know, token ring network 25 years ago or whatever. So yeah. OpenFlow is probably 10 years from now will be an extremely significant network infrastructure technology.
Okay. So I'm looking at a web page here. I've been furiously searching it up while I'm talking to you. So OpenFlow is not S-Flow or NetFlow. It's something completely different?
No, it's a complete control. Basically, you're programming a switch. You're able to take a switch and give it its personality. The IEEE personality of an Ethernet bridge, for example, is manifest as state machines running in software and some centralized controller. What you think of as a switch piece of hardware now becomes almost a slave device programmable from this controller. Think of it almost like switches become more like access points are in a wireless world. And where I have centralized controllers that these access points all snake out from and are controlled from in a centralized way. It's topology aware. It has loop prevention built into the controller and the link state model that it maintains. And it basically reports itself and presents itself to the outside world as if it were one single humongous switch.
So OpenFlow is actually like an API for the switch software. I can drill into it and say, reconfigure the switch according to this process, or I can actually change the whole switching algorithm?
Exactly. So the switch itself presents an OpenFlow API to the controller, and the controller uses the OpenFlow language basically to program the remote switch.
So the controller would be some piece of hardware, and you could have a whole bunch of switches sitting out there, you know, physical hardware switches being managed by this one controller, if you will?
Exactly. Exactly. And so things like, you know, you take a standard Ethernet bridge, I have a MAC learn that comes up. That becomes an exception. The switch then uses OpenFlow API to generate an event and ask the controller what to do with this. And the controller will respond with a forwarding instruction, something to put inside the policy table of the switch. The switch uses OpenFlow API to present that forwarding table and that policy table. Things like ACLs, things like, you know, next hops. All of those are presented through this OpenFlow API and are programmed by the controller.
Okay, so I'm now thinking about RESTful interfaces like NetConf and Beep, and what's one starts with a Y that they've just announced? Those types of technologies you can then actually drive into the switching configuration using the software layer. Is that
exactly?
So exactly. Yeah. Okay. and reconfigure the forwarding processes or more traditional stuff as well, I assume.
Exactly. It's as if the switch is a giant switch and then all physical switches are just, you know, line cards on some sort of tree-like topology.
I'm sort of visualizing there was a software-controlled telephony switch which allowed you to program. It was just a bunch of ingress and egress destinations, and then you could just reconfigure it to do whatever you liked in some way with it. And that's the image I'm now carrying.
Yes. In fact, controller-based networking is long established in the carrier space. Absolutely. It's now established also in the Wi-Fi space with access points and controller pairs. So the data center presents a very similar problem set to access points in the wireless world. If you were to think of, say, a VMware virtual switch as an access point, that's a perfect example of such a management and control hierarchy.
Okay. So now, if I work this correctly, OpenFlow is an initiative from the IEEE?
Actually, no. It's an initiative being led in academia. There is a National Science Foundation trial in place. And because HP was very advanced in our implementation of OpenFlow, we're the experimental switch of choice for all 8 campuses participating in that NSF trial. It's really been primarily driven by a group out of Stanford University who I think got approval for this funding for the NSF trial.
This is all new to me. I've sort of seen this talked about a lot, but I haven't managed to drill into this at any level of detail to comprehend how it works in detail. So I'm sort of, my mind's spinning over this, trying to come up with it. Mm-hmm. Take a break. Did you get that, so, Ethan? Yeah. Have you grokked that?
I think I get it conceptually. Where I'm stuck is trying to understand, you know, Lynn, you said earlier that the x86 architecture is going to have enough processing power to be able to do something like this, but that, you know, I was trying to translate that into, okay, I've got a broadcast storm in my gigantic flat earth network, and you know, this paradigm is going to help me with a situation like that where I've got a whole network that, you know, in today's environment would be on its knees because of this issue. You're implying that an open switch architecture makes this gives us a framework in which that can all be programmed away with software.
That would be the hope, right? That would be the hope. You know, any new technology solves all problems, and it can also, you know, peel paint off your wall and slice onions and things like that. But the idea behind OpenFlow, the idea here is that if you can build a framework for a centralized controller, you can remove or reduce the extent of problems that you encounter that are related to distributed algorithms where you have, you know, built-in split brain from the get-go and you're counting on imperfect protocols to avoid those problems. The hope of a centralized controller is that you have the ability to use more omniscient logic in order to coordinate the configurations of many disparate devices. This is all, of course, you know, a pipe dream at the moment. But because of the success in carrier networks of controller-based networking and the experience people are getting with Wi-Fi, you know, networks of APs that are all controlled from a central place, it looks more and more like a great way to go, especially in the data center where the networks tend to be somewhat crystalline in structure.
Mm. Yeah, true. Our switching infrastructures are rigid. They're manufactured. Yes. You know, we implement them according to these rules because spanning tree forces us down this path. And although we're looking forward to technologies like Trill or SPB and we're waiting for that to come around, what you're actually saying is even during or beyond that point, there's still more flexible mechanisms for network program. So to actually program the network and it to be dynamically respondent to issues.
Exactly.
And your technology support is acting as a platform, as a programming environment for that.
That's correct. HP Labs is our research arm, and they have made great strides in OpenFlow support. They actually changed the firmware for our switches to include OpenFlow programmability. And kind of the way it gets presented in a product is you have VLANs, and those VLANs are either OpenFlow controlled or they're traditional. And if they're open flow controlled, that means that there's sort of a management hook and a remote, basically an RPC mechanism that the controller uses in order to intercept exceptions and to inject routes into the switch for the VLANs that it controls. And HP Labs has done a wonderful job of working with Stanford right there in Palo Alto and advancing the cause of OpenFlow. And by the way, some of the customers who are interested in OpenFlow are the ones you would really be interested in: Google, Amazon, Yahoo, the very, very, very large data center networks.
Well, the potential of that's pretty huge, because people who know exactly what they want from their technology can actually configure it to be what they want it to be.
Exactly. And I think the biggest value they claim they get from something like OpenFlow, it goes back to that distributed brain problem of today's switching world, where I have 100 different units of management, and they all have to be sort of coordinated and in sync. And it's very difficult sometimes to deal with problems when they're not. In the case of OpenFlow, Google will say, well, if I know for a fact that I have an event coming up that's going to suck a lot of bandwidth towards those 25 servers over there,
yep,
I can literally reconfigure multipathing in my network on a custom basis based on what I know ahead of time. I don't have to wait till after the fact or deal with protocols like RSVP, which are very clunky and nobody really uses.
Okay. I really like that idea. But I think what we should do is we should look also at what we need to do today around the A-Series. So let's talk more about what the product that most interests myself is the A12000 and the A7000 platforms, which are, since most of us are going to be familiar with it, I'm going to be a little bit pretentious and say, well, you know, the Cisco 4500 series and the Cisco 7000 series, or in that sort of an area, is comparative to that sort of a product. So if we're comparing those two products, where is the A series, you know, at the higher end, where are they going to have some advantages? What's the better part?
I would say that the A12000 or A12500, you can think of it as almost like a combination of the Nexus 7000 and the Cat 6500 in features around the speeds and feeds of a Nexus. And the 12500 offers, like I say, it's like 510 gig ports, 4-to-1 oversubscribed, very fast crossing, supports everything, 1.5 million routes. You've got MPLS, VPLS, IRF can be used to extend a switch virtualization across a metropolitan area up to 70 kilometers, no spanning tree. Think of a feature in terms of routing and switching, and it's as full featured as anything, with the exception of proprietary protocols. Right, it supports all industry standard protocols and all industry standard types of forwarding and routing.
And that's the really big, really expensive box. Fair?
Yes. Although I think what you'll find is, you know, from a cost of ownership perspective, it's going to sit well below the comparable Cisco products.
Hey, can you get into a 12500 with say redundant supervisor engines and a goodly population of 10 gig ports, say something in the 128 10 gig ports? Are you into how much for something like that? About $100,000 or?
Well, I would not be able to estimate for sure. All I know is from a Delta perspective, fully installed, we hear customers anecdotally will say we're anywhere from 30% to 50% below Cisco for the same RFP.
So you would position a 12500 across from, say, a Nexus 7010 or 7018, something like that.
Yep, absolutely.
That's a fair comparator, yeah.
With a lot more layer 3 features in the A12500 than what you'll get with the Nexus.
Yeah, you said 1.5 million routes. I mean, I'm assuming you've had success with these boxes across a wide swath of customers. I mean, you could put that in carrier space. You can take a full internet routing table with that, and you can also do big enterprise space. So is there any one segment that you've had more success with others? I mean, where would you put this box? Where wouldn't you put this box?
You want a data center, multi-tenant data center with high scale needs is a great environment for an A12500. It's very, very stressful. We support all versions of VRF, by the way, as well, both the light and the label switching version. The 12500 has had a lot of success in very demanding environments. And again, if I go back to some of the carriers in China are using it in the core of their network, there are a couple of customers we have in China with 50,000 and 70,000 devices respectively. And the 12500s are mission critical core of those networks. And they're growing faster than any network that I can think of in the West.
Mm-hmm.
So very demanding environments, very reasonable in terms of the cost of ownership. Again, I can't quote pricing, I would be the wrong person to ask that question. All I know is, again, on a typical RFP, we come in anywhere from 30 to 50% below Cisco.
Sure. That's reasonable. Sure. And then the 7,000, that's the next, would you say like a mid-tier chassis?
Yes. Well, 500 speeds and feeds you can think of as a Nexus 7,000 for in terms of, you know, 10 gig ports and oversubscription rates. But it's got all the layer 3 capabilities that you just don't get with the Nexus 7K today. It does not have fiber channel director capabilities built into it, and that's one of the negative differences, I think, but I'm not so sure it's that negative.
Well, is there FCOE support?
So there's CEE support coming. The 12500 chipsets enable for the multi-priority queue pause mechanism, for example, and the pause at a distance, the QCN, or I think they call it it's the congestion notification message. And they also have the ability to take the egress queues and do that enhanced transmission selection grouping. So basically, we've got full support in the hardware. It's a firmware upgrade coming for the A12500 to have CEE. But I will say this right now, that lossless networking dramatically changes the cost structure of the network you build. And it's a pernicious undercurrent. It's a lot of hidden cost and complexity that people don't think about up front. And if you were going to take and completely converge your lossless storage traffic with your TCP/IP traditional data traffic, you're going to build a much more expensive network than you would if you have the sum of the two. And the reason for that is that if you carry CEE through the core, your oversubscription rates that are acceptable in a lossless fiber channel SAN are much lower than they are in a traditional data network. So you end up having a lot more high bandwidth ports and a lot lower utilization of the switch just to make sure that you can support the lossless capability. And that's if you get more layers of indirection than, say, an aggregation, top of rack type switch.
I was reading a document this week which is very interesting about priority flow control and pointing out that it's actually incredibly expensive to implement priority flow control in a switch because you actually have to signal in the backward direction that the forward path is congested. So what that means is if the egress port is overloaded, you have to signal backwards on the ingress port, which means your switches have to suddenly carry state.
That's right. And the congestion notification heuristic, in fact, is something that will probably be tuned over time as a direct result of what you were just talking about. Because you have to somehow figure out which of those packets in your egress queue represents a top talker that you want to ask to shut up, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And how do you pick who that is? I mean, that's a lot of logic to go around and figure that out.
Yeah.
Letting TCP endpoints figure it out and back off and come back is a far more robust mechanism. That's why the internet took off. And I think that just the cost of carrying that lossless capability through a converged network doesn't make sense.
Well, it's weird. I mean, we just the propagation delay. I mean, you're talking about the speed of light across a 100-meter cable is greater than the time cut through in the silicon on a backplane.
Exactly. And hop-by-hop flow control of Ethernet is not well suited to prediction by senders, by pushers. Mm-hmm. Because it's more of a time-based heuristic.
Yep.
And pause is a poor man's, you know, it's an X off, right? It's a poor man's method of flow control.
Let's go back 30 years, X on X.
Exactly. What made Ethernet cheap was the fact that endpoints handled this and the switch could be dumb.
Yep.
And now we're saying, and now we're going to make it like fiber channel. It's not fiber channel becoming like Ethernet. It's Ethernet becoming like fiber channel.
Well, and I think, Lynn, what you're really stating why FCOE is not exactly taking the world by storm. I mean, it's not a lot of people that are that excited about it because of the challenges that get brought in. As soon as you want to do this and you got to have that lossless fabric on the converged network, it's a big pain in the rear end from the way we've been doing it in data networking for quite a long time now.
Exactly. And the way, you know, zoning, masking, name services, the log in capabilities, all those state machines are on a separate life cycle and they're on a new life cycle as they're layered on top of Ethernet. What ends up happening is if you have a fully converged network, you've got some pieces of your network are in a state of flux while others are very stable. and you're forcing instability into the stable parts if you merge the networks. If they're separate networks, see, I think the more likely play that we see happening is SANs or storage networking becoming consolidated in its own right. iSCSI clustering benefits a great deal from lossless and 10 gig. And so you can see that even if it's not fiber channel, the idea of 10 gig lossless CEE is of benefit. And the same thing is true, in fact, for the way lags occur on NAS devices, for example. Very different type of problem than your typical server problem. So storage networks and the idea of having almost like an open source like stack for a director switch, things like how name services, initialization, zoning, masking, whatever, along consolidated in what I've been calling like a triple play like network where storage is its own focus. And by keeping it separate and distinct from traditional data, I don't force its cost structure on the traditional data network, and I also allow it to evolve on its own life cycle. And it's changing fast.
Well, fiber channel has always been a small proportion of a network. It's always been a tiny, you know, tens or hundreds of ports. It's never been thousands of ports. It just doesn't operate at the same sort of scale that Ethernet is. And it's, I don't think that going forward storage networks will, I think it's going to take several years before we see a full merger of storage data. And the storage industry has got a lot of problems in its own right. At the moment, they've still got spinning Rust problems. So the Rust spinning around in circles is slower than the I.O. of the network. And there's no point in switching to 10 gig FCOE or 1 gig FCOE when a storage unit can't even drive, you know, 20,000, 50,000 IOPS unless you've got some new fandangled array that's got, you know, scaled out controllers and all those types of issues. And if you've got that problem, you've got a whole other networking problem associated with it. So it's hard for me to perceive that fiber channel is an answer to a problem. I think it's a problem in search of an answer.
I completely agree.
Yeah, and we should just leave fiber channel and say, right, fiber channel is great over there, and let's move to some. And I also am not a big fan of iSCSI. I don't think iSCSI is necessarily the future because it needs to change too to adapt to modern environments. It could be more efficient. It could be, you know, better. You know, there's somebody out there should be reinventing iSCSI into something worthwhile.
Well, I think you're seeing that, right? Because if I really want to share data between multiple applications, namespace is the way to do it, and NAS is the fastest growing segment of storage, right? Block storage itself in general has a limited number of use cases where it's ideally suited, and using a file system is always preferable if it's performant enough. And so NAS is definitely the high growth area in terms of storage.
Cool.
Of course, you know, HP just acquired 3PAR. So if you know of any other startups with a 3 in their name, please let me know.
3Com, 3PAR, all that type of thing.
That's right.
Okay, so I want to come back around on the ComStore story. So now I know that ComStore is a software that runs on the A series. And I remember from previous briefings where I've worked with you, and I should make some disclosure. HP has been great to be able to take me over and show me some of their labs and show me some of their equipment. And they've paid for me to go, but they didn't pay me to do anything with it. So just so you're there, that's disclosure. We talked about ComStore being the software platform that runs on all your switches. So there's a consistent IO software image that runs across the platform.
Yes. And that's ComWare.
Oh, sorry, ComWare. My stuff.
That's all right. So that comes with the A series. That was that was originally 3Com IP. And when 3Com formed the joint venture with Huawei, they really industrialized ComWare. And we have one of the most productive software teams in the industry of any type.
Yep. And now that's a key value because it's one software image that runs across the whole thing.
It's yes, absolutely.
And so by one the way, software image all the time. Sorry?
That's right. ComWare comes with everything you care about. I mean, in truth, if you want to turn a workgroup switch into a backbone router, your hardware is going to limit you. So there was no reason in ComWare for us to have multiple images or for us to have a lot of add-ons that we would nickel and dime you over. ComWare comes as a pretty solid singular piece of software that runs the same across the A-Series family. And we're actually going to links over time, and you will see in a few years that the ComWare OS and the ProCurve OS will also have a level of commonality that will cause you to think of them as a single product line.
Okay. So now, in the A7500 chassis that we've talked about before, there's a bunch of modules that go into there. They're not just switching modules or routing modules. There's actually application-type modules as well.
Uh-huh. So we have with both businesses, we had started to partner. HP had a great deal of success partnering with the likes of F5, Riverbed, Avaya, Fortinet. I mean, there's a long list of partners we have with a program we call the Open Network Ecosystem, and we are extending that to both the A-Series and E-Series platforms, where we have essentially x86 servers built into the chassis, as you were pointing out, the compute modules. The same is true, by the way. There are branch routers that we have coming with the A-Series, the MSR 20, 30, and 50. Those branch routers also have these plug-in x86 modules. And, of course, in a branch environment, they're frequently very compelling uses for plug-in compute modules for appliance functions to have, you know, everything in a box that goes to a branch. So 7500, the Pro Curves, you know, the E-Series 5400s, and the routing products all are embellished now with these appliances. And we've taken our partnering program and we've merged the organizations. And probably within a year or less, you'll see some consolidated appliance products that are common to all of our platforms.
Okay. So all those things so there's a certain part of the marketplace where once we've got a chassis in, it's much easier just to put these modules in. So you've got load balancers, WAN accelerators.
And voice gear, you know, anything you find. Avaya has turned out to be a very strong partner of ours. Astra, yep. Security products. And, of course, our own Tipping Point comes in appliance form as well.
Which is IDS, IPS. And quite
exactly
a very successful product in its own right.
Exactly.
Market leading. We also,
that's right. With Acer's, we also got a security blade that basically offers firewall functionality and other threat management capabilities. On that fiber channel note, just to let people know, with the 5820, our top of rack 10 gig, you know, basically stackable switch, we offer now fiber channel module. So you can egress into a fiber channel SAN directly from a top of rack switch with endport virtualization so that you have interoperability with Brocade, Cisco, or whatever other director type switches you may have. And that capability just came out. So the 5820 is quite comparable to the Nexus 5000 type products, for example. And that product is doing quite well in the marketplace right now.
So you'll definitely be doing FCOE products in the future. I mean, for all of our discussions, there's a market for FCOE and you're going to be there.
We do that now. And it's also the case that a Virtual Connect, which we've called AKA Flex Fabric, also offers FCO, you know, encapsulated fiber channel and Ethernet across the C-class blade server backplane. And what Virtual Connect excels in is in creating a consistent environment. It's like a firewall between change domains. I can use Virtual Connect almost like a logical patch panel between the server NICs and the network edge, such that I don't have to reconfigure. I don't see a change in one side when I make a change on the other side. So it's
so we've got a nice we've product. Got an upcoming show with Ken Hanolt in a few weeks, and we're going to try and he's going to try and convince me that your Flex Connect and Flex stuff actually works. Because
you know, if he doesn't convince you, give me a shot, because I think Virtual Connect is a foreign object to a lot of network experts.
Yep.
But there's a value proposition for it that's frequently not really well understood by the server people.
Yeah, I struggle with several things, but not this week. Lynn, thanks very much for being on the show. I really appreciate you joining in and sharing the information that you've got. Is there anything else you'd like to close off with?
No, I think this has been great. Thank you very much.
Ethan, let's close out. What have you been doing this week?
I'm still in the process of replacing old hardware with stuff that's newer and actually works. So that's what I'll be continuing to work on.
And that's it for the show this week. And thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again, in a week or so. Make sure you come back. Thanks to Lynn Neese for coming on the show and Aaron Colopy from HP for organizing this. And Ethan, thanks for joining in. I'm Greg Farrow, and you can find me at etherealmind.com or on Twitter as @etherealmind. Don't forget, leave feedback, email us, follow us on Twitter, and remember, too much networking would never